It's on, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it's on.
Okay, we welcome you to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. You can pick up a declaration at your leisure and spend some time reading that declaration. It's really beautifully written, and it sustains us in terms of giving us a guidepost for the activities here in and around the building. The free thinkers that associate themselves with this cause remain independent in a certain way. They come together as volunteers in order to maintain the premises and the program and the behind-the-scene efforts, loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, loyal to the study and application of the philosophy itself, and therefore avoid side issues and private opinions and personalities and politics and organizational hierarchies and all sorts of things. And rather, the focus is on the philosophy, its principles, the concept of universal brotherhood, how that might become a truth in practicality and pragmatic application, as well as that profound conviction of universal brotherhood and altruism. So those who affiliate with the association use that as the basis for union among all the work. As we look around the world in this room and in the external world, it is understood that there is a welcoming mat out for each and all who are willing to fit themselves by study and otherwise in order to participate in this movement, to be the better able to help and teach others, to serve humanity, and therefore to serve great nature in the evolutionary process. And therefore, regardless of any kind of conditions we can imagine, any kind of limitations or identifications or labels, all of that is set aside, and instead the entire focus in these rooms is the philosophy and understanding, discussing it, and then considering it, and what would it be like if we were to live according to the philosophy. It is also said that the true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In addition to the declaration on the periodical, you can find a statement of association of sympathy available at the book table in the event that you'd like to align yourself with the movement. In keeping with that declaration, there are certain activities during the week. There's a rhythm or a cycle to the week. Each Sunday, the building opens at 10:30. There's someone at the book table to help you if you would like to purchase something for home use. And these classes on Sunday mornings go promptly from 11 to 12, again, setting up a cycle for a community of soul, a community of like-minded folks. This month in November, our theme is the fundamentals of theosophy, and that's very, very pertinent. Today being November 17th, we were reminded earlier today that this is the birthday of the modern theosophical movement. It's 138 years old today. And the fundamental ideas that we would consider this month are those that were brought forth from ancient times into the Western world all those many years ago. This morning's talk will be a panel on reincarnation and the doctrine of hope. Next Sunday on the 24th, the idea will be the key to human progress, and that will end the month. In addition to Sunday activities, there are Wednesday activities at 5:30. A volunteer student is available in the reference library at the front of the building. Anything that you hear during class presentations can be looked up and read individually for private study. We don't have enough to lend things out, but we certainly have a strong straight-line collection of theosophical references. In addition, on Wednesdays, after the library closes at 7:30, there's a class, a study class, that starts at 7:45 and goes promptly until 9, again functioning on the regularity of cycles, and that Wednesday night class this winter will continue to study a collation of articles from the late 1800s, and the book is entitled The Ocean of Theosophy. Before and after any of the classes, during library hours, you could make purchases at the table in the front of a foyer, or if you would rather, you can go online from home, and much of the straight line literature is available at the Phoenix Lodge, the LA Lodge, the New York Lodge, some at our site, and again, you can peruse anything to your heart's content. Everything around you is facilitated by this voluntary association of individual volunteers and students, and certainly if you're interested in participating to help keep these ideas before the public, you're more than welcome to do that. Just speak to anyone that's working the book tables. Now, having said that, the partnership of volunteers this morning are looking at reincarnation as one of the fundamentals of the philosophy of theosophy. The first half of the presentation will be reincarnation itself. This is not anything new, the notion of reincarnation. It is something that is worldwide, that can be traced through ancient religions and philosophies all the way back to the dawn of time, prehistory, if you will. It can also be found in the roots of the various Western religions that modern people think have nothing to do with reincarnation at all. In the last 25 years of the 19th century, a lot of the work about reincarnation and karma, the twin doctrines, were revitalized or revised in that there was an effort given to take these different strains, these different traces of these original ancient teachings, these birthrights, and to pull them back together so that they were available in print for the first time so that people could look at the concepts. So whether you approach this from the Asian philosophical and psychological and religious cultures, whether you look at this from ancient Greeks, whether you're thinking about that period of time when there was this blending, this kaleidoscope of Judeo-Christian thinkers and a variety of different sects, those terms, reincarnation and the notion of life beginning again in physicality, were very, very common. This is the lost chord of Christianity. In 553 of the Common Era, in the Fifth Council of Constantinople, there was actually a political maneuver by an emperor working for political power on a church structure to void the teachings of reincarnation. And there's still, despite those efforts, there's still many, many traces in what Westerners call the New and Old Testament of the teaching of reincarnation. If you're new to this study, you may know terms like re-embodiment or transmigration or metempsychosis. And again, these are different terms that have taken a new twist since 1875. But the original ancient teachings is that once life force or mind or soul or spirit, however you come to consider that notion, once that wave, that impulse hits the human kingdom, that wave stays in the evolutionary track of the human kingdom. So the ancient teachings were that there will be life after life for the self-conscious entity, the human being, that these lives would proceed to unfold according to the doctrine of karma, and that there would be life eternal on the spiritual, the permanent nature of the human being, and life transitory or personal or physical in any one of the particular incarnations experienced. In terms of the 20th century, and certainly in the 21st century, you could come to this consideration from a variety of points of view, and perhaps you've come from one of these views. We could discuss this morning, tracing world religions and philosophies and legends and how that unfolded before that fatal council in 553. We could look at this rather in an analogy and use scientific examples of cycles and what it is to be re-embodied in the world of great nature, cycles, periodicity, cause and effect. We could also look at points of contrast in terms of our experience, what it is to be soul living in a physicality and having that duality, that inner sense of permanence and perception versus the transitions and the different cycles of the human body. We could look at reincarnation and the interplay of the human and great nature in terms of the skies versus the ground. So there's many, many different ways to look at it, and certainly many different logical arguments where folks say, you know, this doesn't make sense in life. Why is there genius? Why are some souls in tremendously handicapped circumstances? How come their tendencies in certain family lines or tribes or ethnicities? Why can I see patterns of 1,500 years between civilizations? Or why does it seem that there just isn't enough time to live out all of the hopes and the dreams and the causes that we might hope to see? And why can't I remember past lives? Lots of considerations. And in terms of reincarnation in general, there's hope also, isn't there?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
Yes, there is hope. That's life can seem pretty bleak at times, for some of us at least. But the prospect of the prospect of not coming back for some is reassuring. They figure that well, this is it. Life is miserable, but I'll just have to do this for 70 or 80 years, and then I'll be eternally rewarded for, for my suffering on this earth. And that's a doctrine that has been put forth by the church and by those in power in order to subjugate the masses. You know, without getting political, that's just that's been the general scheme of things throughout history. But we are intimately connected with all of nature. We've been built up, the monad, which is the true spiritual part of our nature, which is everywhere. It is one. It is, you know, Atma and Buddhi. It is pure spirit and spiritual soul, which is the basis for universal brotherhood, because it connects everything. You know, there's connects the entire web of life, and over periods of manifestation and during periods where there is not manifestation. So we have been built up. The monad has gone through various cyclings through elemental kingdoms, which are forces of nature, and the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, and the human. And so that's when the thinker comes upon the scene halfway through the evolutionary process. And then we start reincarnating as thinking beings. Before, we had consciousness, but we did not have self-consciousness. And animals certainly have consciousness, and they have intelligence. They have instinct. But they don't have that self-reflective consciousness that the human has. So we were taught these doctrines once by great initiates and masters from former rounds of evolution. They had perfected themselves. And that is the goal of reincarnation, is to perfect ourselves, to learn all the knowledge that we can and do all the good that we can and have a harmonious sense of universal brotherhood. Now, we have universal brotherhood right now as a fact, but many of us don't realize that fact. And that's because there's so many divisions and so many dissensions of differences of individual opinion, which we try to avoid here at the United Lodge of Theosophists. So we have been built up, as we said, of the various kingdoms, and that is another reason for universal brotherhood. We have all the kingdoms resident within us, and so we are intimately connected with all of great nature. So, unfortunately, for the past 2,000 years, especially the last 1,500 years, because actually, for the as was mentioned earlier, it wasn't until 553 that it was actually the doctrine of reincarnation was... Actually, the doctrine of reincarnation wasn't anathematized. It was the pre-existence, which is... So it's a... There's a philosophical, you know, there's a non sequitur there. It just, it doesn't make any sense for the whole scheme of things. So pretty much reincarnation did fall by the wayside. So there are 1,500 year cycles, as mentioned, and it's been approximately 1,500 years ago. And since the last quarter of the 19th century, we find ourselves here, we're influenced not only by Theosophy, but many other movements and Buddhism. And so the West has come around to where many, many people believe in reincarnation. Some can remember their past lives, especially small children are the most likely to remember their past lives and to talk about past lives. And if they're not, they're usually told that, you know, be quiet, that's a fantasy or whatnot. But there are many documented cases of children talking about their past lives. So it is a doctrine of hope. And we wanted to read a couple of quotes before we closed. The hope is that we can eventually have a heaven on earth. It's many millions of years in the future. That's the bad news. But we're always in the present, after all. And so whether in or out of incarnation, we always have consciousness, and we're always present. I'd like to read a quote. The daily spectacle of man going from birth to death without profiting by experience or profiting only in counterfeit coin is proof enough that if there be hope for the masses of men, it must depend upon a buried inner remembrance and perception carried from life to life and acting as an unconscious ameliorative influence upon character. So, and another quote in closing, this evolution carried to its highest power is a magnificent prospect. It makes of man a god and gives to every part of nature the possibility of being one day the same. There is strength and nobility in it, for by this no man is dwarfed and belittled, for no one is so originally sinful that he cannot rise above all sin. Your questions and comments are invited at this time. Did you want to call him?
You can. Oh, okay.
Of course, there are many millions of people who believe in reincarnation, as well as millions that don't, or maybe believe in one life and going to an eternal reward in heaven. But aside from the belief, is there anything in our daily experience, whether it's within or outside of ourselves, that can lead to a conviction that it's a fact, that it's a matter of knowledge, not just a belief?
To step away from a belief system, because we're not inviting folks into a new belief system here at all. Is there anything experiential that we all share? Certainly there are unique circumstances with folks that have experienced amnesia who know that before the episode and after the episode they remain the same. But each and all of us, where we are right now as adults, when we wake up in the morning and look in that mirror, the physicality has changed big time across these many decades that we may have lived. But we still have that inner sense of I am. And we think nothing, absolutely nothing, of putting the physical body down for a rest, going into a deep sleep, whether it's an afternoon siesta or whether it's overnight, and then rising again in the morning, gradually coming back to a consciousness of what this personality is about, what the duties of the day are. And we go through that cycle of activity and rest without any complaints. We know we go through the growth. Each of us sitting here had an infancy, had a prenatal condition, had an infancy, had toddlerhood, had childhood. We may not remember it, any of it. We may not remember our dreams coming out of the deep sleep, but we know for sure that there was a pre-existence and there is now a post-existence with the continuity that I am has not changed.
And there's no void anywhere, even in space. Space is full of life and activity and consciousness, and the scientists are discovering this more and more. There's no such thing as an empty vacuum, or there's no such thing as non-intelligence or non-being. There's be-ness and being, and we are both. Be-ness is associated with the deity, which is resident within us, and being is this evolutionary process that we're involved in, this accumulation of knowledge and wisdom and power to be used for, you know, all of nature, for the kingdoms below us that will step into the human kingdom once we've completed that cycle. In the back?
This idea of karma, are we to understand that what we're going through now in this lifetime is something that we ourselves have caused the setup? So we're working on past karma, right? Is there more than just past karma?
We would think that there's past karma that's still in a savings bank, waiting for the correct conditionality to come forward, or waiting for soul working right now in these bodies, in these personalities, to mitigate or ameliorate that what might come at us. There's active karma right now, effects coming that we're facing as soul. And there's certainly karma that we're creating in the moment that will unfold as the time is right, as the energies are correct, either in this life or in future lives. This is a circular situation. We know in the world of science and physics and relativity that, you know, there's these, I want to say conversionality, but relativity, that what is appears to be matter can convert to energy and vice versa. Karma is the same way. It's relative. It's either in an active state or an inactive state. And in many ways, those questions we might have come in with this morning, how come there could be one individual at 60, 70, 80 years old in an almost perfect body, another at 19 or 20 begins to age in an incredible way and has a series of physical ailments. How come one individual may be intellectually acute for their entire incarnation while another begins to lose cognitive faculties gradually across time? What's it all about? And there's an individual study that can be done on skandhas, that efforts, motivations, energies put out generate certain tendencies, certain affinities, certain attractions, if you will, that force, that field is then drawn back to the soul in future incarnations where the field of play is appropriate and can be worked out.
And heredity does not explain everything. It's not mechanical. There are instances of great genius that appear in families where, you know, it was not there before. All of a sudden it pops up. It could be a military genius like Napoleon or a musical genius like Bach. So this karma, which it means action. The word literally means action and subsequently reaction, because every thought, word, and deed has its effect. In the Voice of the Silence, the great poetic and spiritual and devotional book, The Voice of the Silence, says that e'en wasted smoke remains not traceless. So everything makes an impression. You know, if we harbor ill feeling towards others, and we don't act on it, Theosophy teaches that, it's in the philosophy that that the real plane of action is thought. So those thoughts go out there somewhere, and they can be picked up by someone who is passive. And they may act on that unbrotherly thought that you have on somewhere, somebody, somehow. It is mysterious, but that is the way it works. We are told. We are to test, check, and verify this. We are not here to. There's no dogma. There's no. There are things in the teaching of Theosophy, but they. You have to make the teachings real for yourself. You have to see you have to decide for yourself whether you think it's true or false and act accordingly.
Yeah, that's a really key point, because as students, we're studying the philosophy together, and even using the phrase "we are told" sounds like a dogma, and that's not what it's intended at all. As individuals, we can choose to turn the reincarnation on its head and the whole concept of karma and reincarnation into a very dismal teaching. We can choose to pursue a particular line of thought and create that reality for us. And then life will present experiences with which we can figure out, was my starting premise correct? We can also choose the doctrine of hope as a philosophy that we would like to experience, to see the concept of life after life operating in a cyclic absolute justice of cause and effect, with the intent of experience gained benefiting all of the universals that we can imagine, all of the manifestation of the universe that we can imagine. Is that a hopeful thing with which we can live? But the choice and the pursuit is individual, certainly. Way in the back.
Wouldn't you say that the main thrust of hope comes from the fact of the law of karma, that no one and nothing in the universe can prevent me from setting up the causes that I will reap the effect of? So if I want to continue to be wicked, ergo, I will receive all of the difficulty back. But if I change my stance that law still works, and I can go for wisdom and brotherliness. Mm. So it's really karma that is the main heart of the doctrine of hope.
Karma is the doctrine of hope if we have the courage to be self-reliant. There's so many folks that run away from these notions. At heart, they see cause and effect in life. And at heart, they know that there's a difference between I, the perceiver, who is the same across time. You know, the big joke is I'm 16 years old when I first wake up, look in the mirror, and I have a horrible shock. What happened in the last few minutes? There are folks that get that, but they yield to the flavor of the month club, and that seems hopeless, doesn't it? That there are external powers or controls where at times certain folks would be favored with a particular existence or a particular fortuitous life, and then eternally thereafter on the sempiternity of things, they also go into a heaven state and are rewarded, while other souls' flavor of the month are not so popular and therefore face tremendous suffering on this planet. Only then, if they fall or in some way are so grievously sinful, they're eternally condemned. So which is the hopeful stance? And can we learn from watching folks who are grieving the loss of their loved ones? Or the realization of their own mortality and the fear that comes over some thinkers. There was a hand here.
Yes. Do we carry anything from life to life? Is there, do we impress this eternal aspect of ourself in any way that my next life will have something about me that's better than it is now, but it's something inside of me, not so much the karma of my circumstances, but really the moral karma, something that how we look at life and how we treat life. Is there any knowledge that we bring back life after life?
Well, using the analogy of experiencing one life, the body of the tiny infant no longer exists by the time that infant is 32 years old, or 62 years old, or 92 years old. That the transition of form seems to dissipate. But the experience gained, what was alluded to in the question of the ethical or the moral manifestations, all those experiences gained, all of the interpretation that soul has made of all those experiences. There's an anthropological stance that man is the maker of meaning. And so anything that is resident in what we would call the heart or the intuition or resident in the mind, those things that are eternal, those things that come to us in a flash of intuition with no seeming or apparent effort, are part of that impacted nature. And my partner spoke earlier about certain truths being impacted in the very nature of the human being. And those eternal truths, precepts, codes of ethics, those concepts or realizations that we come to after a string of experiences, those things do come back eternally as part of the soul. In the Wednesday night classes, we study the notion of buddhi, of what it is to have an eternal reminiscence or soul memory, soul knowledge of what life can and should be. Can you think of?
Well, it literally was burned into our natures, impacted into our natures, into our very being. And we do carry our experiences and knowledge from lifetime to lifetime, but we need a, we have a different vehicle in each lifetime. So we have different aspects that we need to work on, different lessons that we need to learn, lessons that have been presented many times before, considering we've been reincarnating for over 18 million years. And so there's really no lesson that hasn't been presented to us, but we became so enamored with these forms and we fell into materialism and intellectualism and just using the intellect, not using the Buddhi aspect, that spiritual soul, where the highest intuitional impulses come from and the most brotherly, lovingly loving impulses come from. But the intellect is cold, it's hard, it's calculating. And that's why, you know, we have had so much competition and so much also with going along with the fact if you feel that you only live one life, you want to grab for all the gusto you can get in this one. So it's a combination of the intellectuality and the materialism and the fact that we've been suffering under these limiting dogmas that we feel that we have been told that we are poor, miserable sinners, and when in fact we are sinners as long as we continue to make mistakes and keep to and repeat them, but that's not our nature. That is not our true nature. We're here to recover that and discover that, and also to teach that eventually, to become able to fit ourselves to be better able to help and teach others.
If we pursue the comparative religion and we look at the world, the great world religions, and try to be critically aware of what the nature of the human being truly is, and what might, like the questioner was asking, you know, what repeats? Is it the me, the personality, or what comes again? Is there a soul that has at the heart a spiritual sense of ethics and morality? If you look at comparative religion and forget the whole argument about reincarnation, but just consider how the different world religions look at what's the nature of the true human being, what is the nature of the heaven state. From Christianity comes the statement, the kingdom of God cometh not with observation. Neither shall they say, lo here or lo there, for behold, the kingdom of God is within you. Confucius, what the undeveloped man seeks is outside. What the advanced man seeks is within himself. From Buddhism, if you think the law is outside yourself, you are embracing not the absolute law, but some inferior teaching. From Sufism, if human beings knew their own inner secrets, they would never look elsewhere seeking for happiness and peace. From Hinduism, God bides hidden in the hearts of all. And from Sikhism, God is in thy heart, yet thou searchest for him in the wilderness. So that deific essence, that Buddhi essence, is eternal, and it's within the notion of I am that I am I. And impacted in that is all the nuances of experience that we, from which we make meaning.
Up here.
Not to get off the beaten path here, but a lot of these people that have these near-death experiences talk about something they call the life review.
Yes.
And from what I've read, each life review is specific to that soul, spirit, essence, whatever. If that be true, then that kind of does sort of speak to this idea of maintaining
some part in the soul of our individuality, something of our personality, something.
Yes, well, we get a life review and also a preview after the Devakonic state, which is equivalent to heaven, after we go through the period of bliss where we live out all our highest aspirations, we're given a sketch, we're giving a briefing, as it were, of the life to come. We have an idea of what we're going to be facing. And we take up the burden once again, and willingly, because we know that it is the best possible, the circumstances are the best for learning the lessons, ideally. Now, the life review is, it's told to take place after death within about 12 hours after the body has seemed to be dead, but really we're busy in the brain. The brain is that the organ that is facilitating this review, and we see everything in our life in minute detail from every angle, every possible angle. So we learn lessons that we didn't even really assimilate in life. We're, I guess, in a sense, we learn what we didn't learn. Because we see everything crystal clear. And
And probably on the daily practice, there's Dr. Ian Stevenson and a number of others in the 20th century that have started to record that out-of-body experiences and the life review and all sorts of phenomena are now recorded and in print for folks to look at. And there are many folks who therefore practice daily to echo what might be the life cycle. And so they'll rise in the morning trying to recall the dreams, trying to recapture that moment of clear seeing, what is life about. And for some that may be compassion or patience or universal brotherhood or altruism, the golden rule. And they'll hold that notion in a period of prayer or contemplation, meditation, whatever you want to call it, and then lead the day and then close the activity of the day with a review of where was the moral compass? How did I do with in theory, what I would do as opposed to what I did do? And then again, lay the body down for deep sleep, maybe holding a particular thought, a question that you know needs a spiritual answer. So again, that's a lifestyle, literally, based on scientific evidence, based on religious teachings and philosophical stances. The whole field of psychology has been wide open. The field of neuroplasticity is now wide open. And notions introduced during the 19th century in the Western culture are now really bubbling up with great energy. Yeah?
Well, we've heard the discussion. And our question is, there must be something about us that's not subject to karma, not subject to reincarnation. Otherwise, I mean, there doesn't seem to be much we can do about it. How can I take charge if I don't know who is subject to these laws? And if these laws rule, especially of karma and reincarnation, how do I know and how do I learn from it? Or is my purpose here just to go through suffering, pain, and so forth, pass off and then come back again? Doesn't seem to make sense. There must be somebody in charge who is not affected by all of these current results.
Well, that's known as the observer. All beings are subject to karma, but the observer is that part of our nature which is independent. It does not incarnate. And there's an expression that change cannot see change. Only that which is changeless can observe the change. And everything that we know about in this world has to do with change, especially in this Kali Yuga, where change is rapid, very dizzying pace of change. There's other periods of golden ages where change comes much more slowly. But there is that observer and that sees the change, and it's being-ness in a sense, not being. Again, it's separate. It's can look on the on all the change. Yes.
Then what's the purpose?
What's the purpose? The purpose is to gain wisdom, power, and knowledge. Wisdom and knowledge, and therefore power, to raise up all of life. We're not here just for ourselves. We're here for all of nature. If we think we're just here for ourselves, we're only seeing part of the picture, and we're it can lead to selfishness. We're here to raise up all of nature.
Another possible answer to this, what's the purpose, is to gain experience. To have the experience. Because when we start out on this long travel through many incarnations, if we believe so, we start out with no experience. And over these many incarnations, we gather experience to maybe become perfect. I don't know. I don't know what the goal is. But it certainly has to do something with having the experience and learning from it.
It would seem throughout all of great nature, and certainly in the hearts and minds of very tiny children, there's a strong sense of confidence. They may not know the word perfectible, but they have a sense of progress. I can grow. I can do it. I can learn. And in that sandbox of early childhood, there's the notion of sharing. Children left to their own devices have a strong sense of justice. What's fair play? What isn't fair play? Who should take a turn when? And then they begin to embroider that experience, don't they? Sometimes with parallel play, sometimes with compassionate sharing, sometimes with competition and me first. But they gradually learn and grow. And ultimately, in terms of the psychologist Maslow, the statement of the self-actualizing human being is the soul that gradually fulfills each of its basic needs in the physical life and therefore begins to grow and build and bloom on the intellectual and the spiritual planes. And ultimately, if we look at the paths of the truly great personages across time, do they not all share the impulse to reform, to assist, to help, to promote the growth of others, the protection of others, and the oneness of all life. Yeah.
And we were thinking, isn't that the responsibility side, which we haven't touched on yet today, with karma and reincarnation? We call them the doctrines of hope and responsibility, because what was just described is our ultimate responsibility. But as we go along in this process, it is being aware, being mindful, learning the lesson, looking out for karmic opportunities to help others and fitting ourselves and everything that was said. Mm-hmm. But that's part of it as our responsibility for this lifetime we've been given.
And it's not far away. The individual who is bedbound or in a prison cell and bound, or the individual who has very limited resources because a huge, horrible storm came through, or the individual who's aging not so gracefully, no matter what the constraint or the conditionality of the current experience, there's still resident something far beyond and far superior to the form and to the experience. And we share that humanity in many different ways.
And the karmic field, as it were, is irrigated with our tears and our pain. And we need to learn how to transcend that. All the great souls have been through all kinds of sufferings and trials and tribulations. And as we all have in life, but we need to learn compassion. That is how we learn compassion. And once we have transcended the pain and the suffering, we can look for others. And that's another reason why we're here. We're here to help our brother and sister to get through difficult times. Yes.
Of course, the doctrine of hope as it relates to the individual human being is very important, but how is this a doctrine of hope for millions who don't understand or believe in reincarnation, or for those of the animal kingdom, or the plant kingdom, or the mineral kingdom, or the planet itself, for that?
Well, do they even think about hope? I mean, those other kingdoms, we think that this is a human an aspect of our humanity to think about hope. Not for animals or vegetables or minerals. That's they don't have that self-reflective consciousness which hope is necessary for. Yes?
But is there no hope for them other than to be our servants and build schools?
Well, we hope so.
If philosophically our premise is that all is one, and that coming from a oneness, an absolute that has absolutely no bounds and no attributes, but is this font of potentiality, of energy and love and compassion. And if we think about physical evolution on one hand, and the various stages of matter that appear to be expressed and to gradually become higher and higher and higher in potentiality and of powers. And if we begin to think about the oneness of the spiritual reality, there's the Tao Te Ching is one source that might help with this. There's something which existed before heaven and earth, and oh, how still it is and formless, standing alone without changing, reaching everywhere without harm. To designate it, I call it the Tao. And then further on, all things in nature work silently and sweetly. And then finally, use the light that is in you to revert to your natural clearness of sight. Because as the spirit works in the human kingdom, as we impress the substances of our physicality, as we impress the lives around us, as we impress great nature, as we interact and create with one another, what's happening is there is a spiritual force in evolution, and if all is one, then gradually across many grand incarnations, manvantaras, huge eons of time, the life that is expressed currently in the energy or molecular field, in mineral, in vegetable, in animal, very gradually will be uplifted and transformed and transcended. And if we stop and think, there's tremendous hope in that we are all one. We are all radiance of a one. We're all interactive. And that if we can see growth and potential and beauty in one aspect of nature, it exists in potentiality in all.
doesn't our physical body, embody all of the kingdoms? Mm-hmm. So we are impressing all of the kingdoms right now, as we talk, as we think, as we act. Yep. So that there is the ultimate responsibility, because all these lives are being affected by us individually and as a group.
And what we impress right now in what's magnetized or has gained an affinity for the energies we're using in this moment, those lives leave us in a myriad of ways and go out into the general pool and are picked up and used by other thinkers. So how do we want to use those lives and send them forth for the good of someone else? It's a big responsibility.
Yes.
How do you connect the doctrine of karma with the concept of everything being energy? Because I've often wondered, like, you know, if we're all made of energy and we're constantly attracting and repulsing other energy forms, is that the nature of how karma works? So that if I am able to, like, for instance, through active forgiveness and the practice of compassion, change the energy in my field, have I completely changed my karma? Mm.
Well, we think so. We think so, that we can change karma. Karma is not fatalism. It's, you know, we are destined to face certain things and learn certain lessons, but we always have free will and choice, and we have that spiritual will that can change the world. One person can. We all do change the world, unknowingly, perhaps. But and if we can transcend all of our feelings of our ill feelings of harboring any ill will towards any being, if we can fully transcend that and feel love and peace and acceptance and joy, oh, that spreads over the whole world. That doesn't, mm-hmm. and it changes. It does change karma.
The fact of cause and effect, that what we put out is going to return to us, that's going to proceed. Events of life, because we create our own destinies, don't we? In the way that we think, in the way that we motivate, in the way that we create words and the tones of the words that we use. So we're in the process of creating a destiny, and just like we throw the pebble in the pond and the ripples return to where the pebble went in, as we sow an idea or a strong, passionate feeling, those effects will return. They're going to come. How we meet them again in a time of crisis, in a time of a chronic situation, how we accept the results of our former actions and make meaning of it and try to raise it up and try to transmute it, try to use the experience to help and serve others, that mitigates the event. So yes, the effect comes, that's absolute justice. The mitigation is where we live in the mind and how we accept it or work with it or work through it.
And that, we just wanted to add, that is alchemy. That is turning lead into gold when we can transmute these energies. That's the true meaning of alchemy.
We have less than a minute left. Do you have
and that just proves why we can never judge another.
Yes.
We should remember, Pythagoras was murdered. If he wasn't a soul living with wisdom and brotherliness, then who was? So one can be in the process of changing. That doesn't mean that their life becomes wonderful.
And the change, if we live in our minds, if we are, as all those religions have taught since ancient times, that the reality of each human being is deep within, and if we know the struggle as persons, as physical bodies, trying to find that inner and hold the oneness, why would we ever begin to judge another or deem another less than. The struggle is one, and therein lies the hope.
And the next meeting, next Sunday, will be the key to human progress, and which will wrap up the fundamentals of theosophy for the month of November. And we invite you to come on Wednesday nights as well for our studies in the ocean of theosophy. Meeting adjourned. You squeeze it again, do you? And then turn.